It is Friday, March 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us today. Coming up, capturing an Islamic State operative, complications of monitoring sanctions against North Korea.
How will we know when it's being violated, and what will our countries be willing to do if it is violated?
Also ahead, Syrian peace talks about to resume, plus controversy over a new biopic. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. An elite U.S. Special Forces operation team has reportedly captured what the New York Times describes as a significant Islamic State operative in Iraq and could apprehend and interrogate others in coming months. It quotes American defense officials as saying the capture is a crucial development in the battle against the IS group in both Iraq and Syria. Ambassador James Jeffrey, who was posted to Iraq during U.S. President George W. Bush's administration, is now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He tells VOA this appears to be the first major success by the new expeditionary targeting force operating in both Iraq and Syria.
It was specifically cited repeatedly by Secretary of Defense Carter as one of the ideas that we would have, that they would go after high-value targets, leadership targets, and use them not only to take out leadership, but also to exploit them for intelligence. We did this, you remember, some months ago with the Emir for Finances, took him out and got his wife. He was killed, but the wife yielded a lot of intelligence. And that's exactly what they're doing. And this is a pattern that the high-end black special operations people did in Iraq for years very effectively.
And with the U.S. military saying very little about what happened with the capture, we asked Jeffrey if he has any idea how they carried out the mission.
Very, very professionally. There is all kinds of tradecraft that vary from operation to operation. The kind of information they're looking for is where do these, first of all, the morale of enemy forces, where their locations are, who their top leaders are, what their plans are, and high-value targets such as concentrations of weapons. One thing that we always would look for is IED manufacturing, basically somebody's backyard where they were, somebody's garage where they were putting together IEDs. So that kind of thing is very, very important.
Ambassador James Jeffrey of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Amnesty International is accusing Russia and Syrian forces of deliberately targeting Syrian hospitals and medical facilities with airstrikes to ease the path of pro-regime ground forces advancing into northern Aleppo. Meanwhile, the United Nations Special Envoy for Syria reports the cessation of hostilities in Syria is largely holding, so political talks aimed at ending the five-year-long civil war will be resumed next week as planned. Lisa Schlein is in Geneva with the story.
UN Special Envoy Stefan de Mistura says the cessation of hostilities in Syria lasted for 6 days, noting this is one of the longest periods of relative calm in Syria's 5 years of war. He says the level of violence has been greatly reduced and that the cessation of hostilities agreement is generally holding, which is good news for many Syrian people.
Unfortunately, we have to admit, like in every cessation of hostility or ceasefire, and in particular in this one, there are still a number of places where fighting has continued, including parts of Hama, Homs, Latakia, and Damascus. But they're being contained.
De Mistura says UN personnel are closely monitoring what is happening on the ground. When a potentially hostile and violent situation is identified, he says they quickly jump in to get the warring parties to defuse the situation before it gets out of hand.
The situation, therefore, could be summarized as fragile. Success is not guaranteed, but progress has been visible. Ask the Syrians. We are committed to make it work. And of course, that is the hope of everyone.
De Mistura says the peace talks, which were abruptly suspended on February 3rd, will resume on March 9th. Since government and opposition representatives refused to meet face-to-face, he says he will conduct proximity talks as before. He says this allows a lot of flexibility, so not all of the delegations need to be present at the opening session. He says he will stagger the days of arrival of the various groups. UN officials say the cessation of hostilities agreement has made it possible for UN and partner agencies to deliver food, medicine, and other aid to 115,000 Syrian civilians living in areas under siege by government or opposition forces. They say last year, aid agencies were unable to access any of these areas. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And still ahead on International Edition, the EU chief warning economic migrants not to travel to Europe.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
European Council, the Union Council president, has warned that migrants should not be going to Europe, saying they will be risking their lives and money for nothing. Henry Ridgewell has our report.
Arriving in Athens Thursday for emergency talks with Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, European Council President Donald Tusk gave a stark warning to potential migrants thinking of travelling to Europe.
I want to appeal to all potential illegal economic migrants, wherever you are from. Do not come to Europe. Do not believe the smugglers. Do not risk your lives and your money. It is all for nothing. Greece or any other European country will no longer be a transit country.
The United Nations estimates that more than half of the arrivals in Greece are fleeing war in Syria or Iraq, legitimate refugees rather than economic migrants. Ian Bond is from the London-based Centre for European Reform.
It's the sheer effort of trying to process those and to separate the legitimate refugees from those who are just economic migrants, which I think is really overwhelming the resources that Greece and its EU partners have been able to put into the problem at the moment.
Night and day, on the main highway heading north through Greece, hundreds of migrants walk the last few kilometres towards the border with Macedonia. The frontier remains effectively closed as tightened border controls across the Balkans have had a ripple effect further south. Thousands of people are camped out at the frontier. Babar Baloch is spokesperson for the United Nations Refugee Agency.
I think certainly anger is building up. People are very restless with families, with children, with women, that they have been here for many days, and there doesn't seem to be a resolution to this. But that's our worry and our concern.
Many Syrians say they have fled airstrikes carried out by government forces and their Russian allies. NATO's supreme commander in Europe, US General Philip Breedlove, has warned that Moscow is, in his words, weaponizing the refugee crisis. Meeting in northern France Thursday, the French and British leaders said they would pressure Moscow to end its attacks against Syrian civilians and the moderate opposition during a conference call with Russian President Vladimir Putin scheduled for Friday. A shaky ceasefire in Syria appears to be largely holding. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And coming up, the latest on the standoff between North Korea and the United Nations. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. North Korea has fired several short-range projectiles off its eastern coast hours after the UN Security Council unanimously approved a new resolution that U.S. UN Ambassador Samantha Power described as the strongest sanctions imposed in more than two decades in a bid to halt the North's prescribed missile and nuclear programs.
This resolution represents a seismic shift in the way the Council approaches DPRK proliferation concerns. It recognizes at its core that in order to prevent the DPRK from continuing to advance its nuclear weapons program, the international community has to be prepared to sanction sectors beyond those directly related to the nuclear weapons program or their ballistic missile program. Let me be clear, though, the true measure of Resolution 2270 will be whether the rigor with which states implement these sanctions matches the rigor we can anticipate the DPRK will apply to attempting to evade them. While this resolution adopted today is robust, comprehensive, and unyielding, to be effective, it must be followed with robust, comprehensive, and unyielding enforcement.
North Korean state media says that leader Kim Jong-un has ordered his military to be ready to use its nuclear weapons, in his words, at any moment, in what is Pyongyang's latest angry response to expanded UN sanctions against it. RAND Corporation Korea expert Bruce Bennett tells VOA's Victor Beatty questions remain over just how effective the new sanctions will be and how strictly they'll be enforced.
Most of the sanctions have some element of exception associated with them. So coal can be sold if it impacts the livelihood of the coal miners. Well, okay, so North Korea doesn't sell its coal, the coal miners aren't going to get paid, so it does affect their livelihood. Will that actually be practiced, or will it be enforced as originally intended? And many of these things are uncertain, especially the enforcement mechanisms. How will we know when it's being violated, and what will our countries be willing to do if it is violated?
Council diplomats quoted by Reuters say these sanctions are even tougher than the ones imposed on Iran over its nuclear program.
Yes, but there it was pretty clear that everybody was on board to enforcing the sanctions. It's less clear that Russia, given the exceptions it introduced today, and that China are as much on board. We're just going to have to see by their behavior.
The U.S. UN Ambassador Samantha Power says these are hugely significant, but she also acknowledged that the North Koreans are masters of evasion.
Exactly, and that's the real issue. I mean, these sanctions, they are much, much tougher. But the key issue is, will they get imposed or will they not? We'll see over the coming weeks.
Are you satisfied these sanctions will do at least something to hurt the missile and nuclear programs in North Korea?
Yeah, I think they will do at least something. The question is, these sanctions probably in and of themselves, even if well enforced, probably aren't enough to force North Korea to stop those programs. North Korea is very determined on them, but they may be enough to significantly cripple those programs if adequately enforced.
Well, Bruce, China's ambassador expressed some concern about the possibility that a U.S. anti-missile system would be deployed to South Korea, and he talked about a call for a return to dialogue, the six-party process.
Well, I think if China had acted like a great power in the first place, North Korea would have never been allowed to develop the Nodong or the Musudong missiles that pose the threat that the THAAD missile system, defense system, is designed to deal with. Now China needs to decide to act like a great power and get those weapons removed from North Korea.
And the RAND Corporation's Bruce Bennett also says, as for the six-party talks, North Korea wants to return to those to be declared a nuclear power, not to be denuclearized, and under that circumstance, the U.S. will not return to the talks. He also says the sanctions could have a destabilizing effect on North Korea. Well, let's check in now with International Edition's G. Abby Lee about what's being said online about North Korea, those U.N. sanctions and all. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. As you know, North Korea has yet to announce any official statements on the issue, but it did express it's not happy about it. To elaborate on what you said earlier, the communist country fired 6 projectiles into the EC early Thursday, and South Korea's defense ministry said they were either rockets or guided missiles.
Speaking of South Korea, what's the reaction like there?
South Korean media outlets are focusing on the fact that Pyongyang has yet to come out with an official statement on the strongest set of sanctions against the country in history. That's quite unusual for Pyongyang because it usually responds to UN resolutions almost immediately. It mostly uses any number of its state-owned media outlets like the Korea Central News Agency or KCNA. Let's check out some comments to an article by South Korea's biggest news agency, Yonhap. One person wrote, "Chung Un, referring to the North Korean leader, the policy of stubbornness you inherited from your father is not working anymore." Another person wrote, "Even if you rubbed the U.S. the wrong way, you shouldn't have gotten on China's bad side. I don't think even Beijing would help you out at this point."
Well, the comments have points. What about from here in the United States? What's the public reaction like on social media here?
Steve, North Korea firing a few short-range projectiles into the sea is not really making headlines, but the country is still being the butt of jokes for firing them into the sea. Eric Idle is a prominent American writer, and he tweeted this. "North Korea fires 6 short-range missiles into the sea. It's not yet clear whether the sea has surrendered." Another Twitter user wrote a similar comment. Harry Shearer is an actor/comedian, and he wrote this tweet. "North Korea fires 6 short-range missiles into the sea. That will teach the pesky ocean." That's all for me today. Steve?
Yeah, many thanks to you, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. And now the subject is U.S. politics. Former presidential candidate Mitt Romney heavily criticized the current Republican frontrunner, Donald Trump, in a remarkable speech on Thursday, casting him as unfit to be president of the United States. Romney appealed to Republican voters to consider the consequences of a vote for Trump in caucuses and primaries across the country, saying, "If we Republicans choose Donald Trump as our nominee, the prospects for a safe and prosperous future are diminished." Later Thursday, Trump lashed back, calling Romney's remarks nasty. While the Republicans bicker, not much attention is being paid right now to the Democrats. For that reason, International Edition's Jim Stevenson speaks with VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone about Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton looking even stronger over her challenger Bernie Sanders following the voting on Super Tuesday.
They both played to their strengths. I mean, Clinton continues to really rely on African-American voters, so the diversity populations work for her in some of those larger states and in the southern states where there are a large percentage of Democrats who are African-American. That really paid off. Bernie Sanders has his strengths among basically white progressives, especially in small caucus-style states, smaller populations. Only committed people come out in those races, and they tend to be on the left side of the Democratic Party and perhaps not that excited about Hillary Clinton's candidacy, but certainly excited about Bernie Sanders. His math problem is, though, that Clinton is getting off to a very big lead, and even though the Democratic Party uses a proportional formula all the way through its primaries, he would have to start winning the rest of the contest by, say, 60% or more to make up that lost ground in the delegate count.
And that's highly unlikely.
It is.
I heard from a few commentators watching the television coverage that Hillary seems to be borrowing elements from the other rivals in her speeches. She gave a few points that Bernie Sanders has been pounding about the wealthy elites and that, you know, things need to change. Even from Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland, she was talking about green energy and sustainable energy across the country.
I think I heard a comment during her speech. It said something about the billionaire class, and that's right out of the Bernie Sanders playbook. And you know what? You're going to hear more of that. I think the other thing you're going to hear more of is so much of her address was directed at the Republicans in general and specifically at Donald Trump, even though she didn't mention him by name. And I think we're going to start to see this dance where the two almost presumptive nominees, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves, are going to be kind of eyeing one another and sparring via long distance. particularly if the trends continue for both contenders and they build delegate counts, we're going to have a much ramped up and much sooner than expected general election campaign, whether people want it or not.
And for the remaining primaries, that's kind of a signal to voters that, hey, if this front runner is not paying attention to his competition, he's looking at the other party, he's serious.
Not only that, by all signs, no surprise here, it's going to be kind of a negative campaign. Donald Trump is not shy about throwing the mud, and the Democrats will have to come up with a way to counter that. And the Clintons have shown over the years they're not averse to that.
VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone speaking with my colleague Jim Stevenson. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Coffee shops are once again percolating in South Korea. In fact, 2015 was a record year for coffee bean and product imports. Since Starbucks' arrival in 1999, thousands of coffee shops have bubbled up throughout Asia's fourth largest economy, including private shops that are discovering new ways to be more creative in order to compete. Seo Min Jin runs her own shop made mostly of sea salt. She says, we used 8 tons of sea salt to build this coffee shop. Customers like it. Add to the ambiance some medicinal coffee and other unique products, and you might snag a niche market. She says, I learned online about the healing cup of coffee served by this cafe, so I came here to experience it. Coffee didn't make its way to Korea until the 19th century. Today, it's considered one of the peninsula's most popular drinks and has grown to become the second biggest coffee importer in Asia after Japan. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. A new film about jazz musician and civil rights activist Nina Simone is causing some controversy because actress Zoe Saldana is in the lead role. International Edition's David Byrd speaks now with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the controversy and what it means for African Americans.
She started off as a jazz musician, just kind of doing the standards. And then as the civil rights movement began to catch fire, she decided that she wanted her music to be of purpose, to have a purpose beyond just entertaining. And so she became heavily involved in the civil rights movement, both with Dr. King and some of the more kind of revolutionary folks as well. So, I mean, she was not shy. She was not afraid. She was unapologetic about her passion and that being civil rights.
And I'm going to step out here, and if this offends you, I'm sorry, but it's the title of the song. Her song, Mississippi Goddamn, mm-hmm. was one that just, like, shoved it right in people's faces, because people who could sit back in the club and, you know, enjoy the jazz, it's almost like Strange Fruit by Billie Holiday.
Right, right.
All of a sudden, it's like, look at this.
Right, right.
And now, Zoe Saldana, who is Latin American, Latina,
Dominican and Puerto Rican,
right, has been cast to play her.
Mm-hmm.
But Zoe's complexion is significantly lighter than Nina's was. Nina's was a dark African American complexion.
Yes.
And so that's the controversy, right?
Well, that and the prosthetic nose. And I think it's important for us to kind of put this in context and to understand that in America, and especially in the African-American community, you have what they call colorism and the idea that light skin is somehow better than dark skin. In fact, that's all over the world. Let's be perfectly honest. One of the problems is that Nina Simone was unapologetically dark skinned. It was part of who she was. As much as, for example, you're a tall man, that's a part of who you are, how you move through the world and how people interact with you. So to have someone who not only can't understand what it feels like to move through the world as a dark-skinned Black woman, try to portray that, and then also to have someone who is of Latina descent, I think is really upsetting people, and that they have to go through so much in order to make her look like a convincing Nina Simone, when there were other actresses.
Viola Davis,
Uzo Aduba, Audra McDonald, India Irie. I mean, one after the other.
Now, Erykah Badu maybe could have pulled it off.
Maybe. And I think it's important to mention that there were reports that the role was originally given to Mary J. Blige.
Right.
Who decided not to do it. We don't know why. but decided not to do it. And I think it's also important to mention that this isn't a story about Nina Simone's entire life. This is a story about one segment of her life and her relationship with a young man that she met at the later stage of her life and developed a really interesting relationship with. So the family was a little upset about that part as well.
And if you want to see the real Nina Simone and you have access to Netflix, you can find the documentary What Happened, Miss Simone.
Which
and that's
is phenomenal.
A wonderful. If you want to see the lady herself in action, look that up.
Yes.
And if you want to send a tweet to Shauna, she is at VOA Lady DJ. You can hit us up. We're at VOA underscore IE. And you can also find us on our website, voanews.com.
Many thanks, you, David, and to Shauna. I have seen that documentary. Excellent. If you can have access to it, you should find it. One other story for you. A police officer in the U.S. state of Utah got a surprise the other day when he pulled over a car carrying the iconic soul singer Gladys Knight. Knight was being driven to a Mormon gathering when the driver of the car was speeding. Well, the policeman naturally pulled the car over. He went up the side of the car. They got into a conversation during all of this. Knight learned that it was his birthday, so the policeman got an impromptu rendition of Happy Birthday from the soul singer. That was an event and a half. Anyway, the policeman said he probably wouldn't have given a ticket anyway, and he did not give a ticket. A spokeswoman for Knight said the singer, who lives in Las Vegas, was in Utah for a choir rehearsal. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. I hope everyone has a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After a recent meeting with his National Security Council team, President Barack Obama said the only way to defeat ISIL in a way that lasts is to end the chaos and the civil war that has engulfed Syria for the last 5 years. The cessation of hostilities that was agreed to by Russia, the United States, and other members of the International Syria Support Group on February 22nd, and which went into effect February 27th, is a test, Mr. Obama said, of whether the parties involved are truly committed to negotiations. The process agreed to in Vienna is clear: a transition toward a more inclusive, representative government, a new government, a new constitution, followed by free elections. Acknowledging differences with Russia and Iran on the issue, President Obama reiterated his conviction that Syria's new future cannot include Bashar al-Assad.
It's clear that after years of his barbaric war against his own people, including torture and barrel bombs and sieges and starvation, many Syrians will never stop fighting until Assad is out of power. There's no alternative to a managed transition away from Assad. It's the only way to end the civil war and unite the Syrian people against terrorists.
President Obama said that a political settlement that would end the civil war means that all parties could then turn their attention to the crucial task of destroying ISIL.
And that's why the United States will do everything we can to maximize the chances of success in this cessation of hostilities. At the same time, I want to make totally clear that there will be absolutely no ceasefire with respect to ISIL. We remain relentless in going after them.
President Obama noted that the U.S.-led coalition with its local partners and allies is making headway in shrinking the core of ISIL in Syria and in Iraq. ISIL's control of territory has been diminished. Its leaders have been killed. Its flow of foreign fighters has been slowed. Its finances have been disrupted. The fight against ISIL will remain difficult, said President Obama, but we will continue to draw on all elements of our national power, military, intelligence, diplomacy, homeland security, law enforcement, and the strength of our communities. And I am confident that we will prevail.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.